Thank you very much indeed, Joe. And I'd like to move on to Mary Sharp. Mary is the founder of Sharp Thinking, which is an Edinburgh-based educational consultancy. As well as being experienced as an advocate in Scotland, she's been a civil servant in Brussels, a researcher and a tutor at the University of Cambridge. She's also trained in applied psychology and neuroscience, and has written on sex, addiction, and the challenges of internet pornography for young people. I know something that Robin was speaking about earlier. She co-organised the first ever TEDx Glasgow event last year, and she has just started an educational charity called the Reward Foundation. So I'm happy to hand over to Mary.
Thank you very much, Jim. Well, it's very difficult following two amazing speakers. I mean, it's rare to come to an evening event and have the privilege of listening to someone like Robin and then someone like Joe. I mean, it's just fabulous. So I'll do my very best to try and follow in their wake. Now, I thought, first of all, that my job, to some extent, was to do a critique of this very big report. Can I ask, just for a show of hands, how many people have actually read this World Happiness Report? I suspected as much. Well, just let me show you something. That's it. And I was reading it last night because, having returned to the law as an advocate here in Scotland after being away for 20 years, reading voluminous documents is unfortunately very much par for the course, but you get used to reading things quickly and trying to look for the key items. And there were a few key things that struck me about that report, because this report came out in 2012, and it's supposed to be the basis of a policy document for governments to try and make us happier. But the first thing that struck me about it was that it reminded me of work that I've been doing for about the past 8 or 9 years. Because before I came back to Scotland to resume a career as an advocate, I was doing international relations work for NATO, in fact. Because after 9/11, they decided that the Reds under the bed were no longer the threat, but Islamism. And they didn't know what to do about that. So they gathered together lots of people who might have some new ideas and new thinkings about conflict resolution. And so I was part of a group of people with a blank slate, basically looking at what is security in the 21st century. And security actually isn't that much different from happiness, because it is a nightmare to try and define it. And let me tell you, neither NATO nor WHO or whoever really has a definition that people are happy with. But what we did discover, because are you talking about the security of the individual? Well, do you feel safe in your own home? The levels of domestic violence or the child abuse that goes on, if we were to believe everything we read in the papers, certainly in the criminal courts and even the civil courts, there is such scare stories and fact that it makes us wonder, you know, are we safe even in our own homes? Are we safe walking down the street? You know, are we safe from environmental degradation? Are we safe from advertisers? Can't we even watch our own television, but they're trying to sell us goodness knows what? We can hardly go to our computers. Anyway, the whole issue was that security means different things to different people. So I felt a certain comfort when I was reading this huge report, because they tried to throw in everything but the kitchen sink. And we had the same problem. But when we were looking, and it was a multidisciplinary approach, we had psychologists, social psychologists, we had economists, we had a whole range of people, geographers, you name it. We decided it was social sciences and the life sciences should come together to try and understand what makes for security in the world. Now, as a result, I was quite familiar with a lot of the research that's in this report. And I have to say, Layard, you had some worries about him, well, but not unfounded. Because Sir Richard Layard, or Lord Layard, was very influenced by a group of positive psychologists, particularly Martin Seligman, who looked at happiness, and he wrote lots of books on happiness, and the whole positive psychology movement is about happiness. And basically they had gone back to Aristotle and the other great Greeks and said, what do they say about it? But unfortunately, because as scientists they didn't really like things like morality or spirituality, they just decided to ignore all that. And I've been in the presence of Martin Seligman when he said that. Now, unfortunately, Aristotle was all about growth of the soul. And when he talked about happiness, he divided it into two main types. Hedonic happiness, which is a short-term pleasure that you get from basic appetites like sex, food, honours, you know, achievement, that sort of thing. In the short term, subjective pleasure. So we see a lot in this report about subjective well-being. But he also talked about eudaimonic happiness. Now, eudaimonic happiness is the long term. It's you in Greek means good, and daimon means spirit. It's the individual, it's your soul. It's what makes you unique, your personality. So making the good soul, is making what is unique to you, is bringing out the best in you, is what makes the eudaimonic life. Now, listening to Joe and what Joe was saying about his incredible moment of happiness. Sorry.
It was his then, you're right, his.
At that time, yep. I understand.
Yep.
It was due to, if we were to characterise this, it was a life well lived. It was a long, happy marriage with 33 years, with children, creativity, and obviously great love, and not just love between them and the family, but from all these friends. Now, that is an example of a eudaimonic life, a life well lived from an objective point of view. What upsets me about this report is it takes a sort of Layard and other positive psychology's approach to the Aristotelian notion of happiness and skims over it without looking carefully at that. And understanding the difference between the short-term subjective hedonic pleasure and the purposeful, the good life as seen objectively. Now, the reason I'm concerned about that is because, and this plays right back into Robin's talk of advertisers and addiction, what Aristotle and the Greeks were very concerned about was how do we control our passions? How do we control all our desires? Because what the positive psychologists don't talk about is that unless you lead a balanced life, then if you just chase pleasure, then unfortunately you overstimulate a part of the brain, and we know this because of the recent developments in neuroscience, not psychology, but hard life sciences, is that you overstimulate the reward circuitry of the brain. And the reward circuitry is the seat of all our motivations, all our desires. Its primary function is food and sex, and so those are taking risks, because those are our natural rewards, because those helped over millions of years. That helped us. If we had enough food, we could grow up, and then when we get to puberty, reproduce. Even if we don't want to reproduce, we can do it. But that part of the brain can be hijacked if we don't use it, and if we don't balance our love and eating healthily and regularly, then we're much more likely to substitute drink, drugs, all kinds of other things for that. Now, the challenge is that for adolescents, when the hormones come on stream, they are even more susceptible to dopamine, which is produced in the reward circuitry. They are more susceptible to addictions. And today, we are surrounded, although we've evolved for scarcity, because there weren't enough people around to have sex, but there wasn't enough food around, we're now surrounded by food, we're surrounded by junk food, we're surrounded by sex, particularly through the internet, and we have overstimulated that. So what the big concern really today is about addiction. That is the key thing that the policymakers have to focus on. Unfortunately, in the past 2 years, there's been tremendous development in research that helps us understand what addiction is, how it affects our lives, and what the whole process is. I'm going to tell you very quickly because my time's running out. I want you to think of two frogs. Frog number one, if you take a frog and you put it in hot water, what does it do? It jumps out. Because its reflexes say, this is too hot, this is uncomfortable, this is painful, and we're designed to avoid pain and seek pleasure. It jumps out, and it's safe. So the stress mechanism kicks in, fight or flight, it flees, but quick. You put frog number two into cold water, and you slowly turn up the heat. Then that frog will stay there as it gets used to, as it acclimatizes to the heat. You can keep turning that up until it boils and it dies. So it's a process, it's a slow process of becoming used to it. And that's what happens in the process of addiction. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process. So the key for educators and for policymakers is to teach our young people in particular, but this is for all ages, but particularly our young people because they're the most vulnerable, is the workings of the reward circuitry. This is the key of all motivation. Teach them how it works because we're not born with an instruction manual, but we've got to learn how that part works. Because if we can do that, we can have safe, loving, happy relationships. We can be productive, we can be creative. We can have that eudaimonic life. We can be authentic, we can be all the great things that spiritual leaders have tried to do because religions have always tried to teach us how to have the happy life, the good life, and forgotten that. But drawing on philosophy, psychology, and neuroscience in particular, we can then learn to react appropriately to this changed environment, the mad complex, advertising-driven environment we're in, and we can critically choose what's going to be right for us in the long term, not just satisfying our short-term pleasures, which can lead us to addiction and serious unhappiness, whether in our relationships, our jobs, or our bank account, but actually to have a balanced, happy, long life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. I think we'll have a big round of applause for everyone. Thank you very much.